got a Bible, I hope you will turn to Matthew chapter 5. If you don't have a Bible, don't leave here without one. Just go to the connection desk and we will make sure to put one in your hands. I want to focus on verse 13 to 16 as we continue to work our way through the Sermon on the Mount. By the way, we're going to take, this is our last Sunday in the Sermon on the Mount. Next Sunday, believe it or not, is already the first Sunday of Advent. So we're not going to power through the Sermon on the Mount. We're actually going to spend some time thinking about Christmas, thinking about Christ's coming and what that means. And when Emily mentioned the idea that we're going to have three Sundays in December with only one service, and so the 11 is eliminated, the reason we have to do it that this, usually we do at 10 o'clock when we don't have an 11, we meet in the middle. But with Falkland and needing to still run our live stream at 9, this is kind of one of the new things we have to kind of work through. So the Sundays, just so you know, are the Sunday of Bethlehem Star, which typically we just do one service because it's a pretty exciting and exhausting weekend. And then Christmas Eve lands on a Sunday, so there'll be one in the morning and then two in the afternoon. And then New Year's Day Eve, I guess New Year's Eve also lands on a Sunday. So in those Sundays, it's going to be full. It'll be exciting, but we'll make sure we just all pack in together, and it will be wonderful as we celebrate Christ's coming and all that means to us. But today we are in Matthew chapter 5, looking at these verses. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. These are probably some of the better known words out of the Sermon on the Mount. After all, even just that simple statement, you know, to be the salt of the earth is used not just in Christian circles, right? People have grabbed a hold of that. It's like, oh, that just kind of means to be like a real kind of genuine, down-to-earth person who you can kind of count on, salt-of-the-earth kind of fellow, salt-of-the-earth kind of lady. But as we're going to see today, Jesus has something, I think, much more particular in mind as he says what he says. Now, what I want to do is look at these two, I'm not sure whether to call them analogies. Some people would actually call them parables. I think they're probably more analogies to what it means to be followers of Jesus. So we are going to look at those two things in just a couple moments, and then look at some of the implications if these things are true, which I believe they certainly are. But if they are true, what are the implications of these statements that Jesus is making? And then look at one particular application of how we might live this out. And then look at one, what I hope is an encouragement as we come to our end of our time together. So that's kind of my plan. But before we get into all of that, I need to take you on a little trip. I wish I could literally do it. Put you on a plane, maybe not right now, fly you to Israel, take you to the north part of the Sea of Galilee, take you up on a hillside, sit you down. And I wish I could have the conversation I want to have with you now, right there. Because if we could be at that spot, we would be at the spot that Jesus was at with his disciples as he went outside of Capernaum up onto a mountainside and sat down and began to teach. And it's easy to sort of forget the geography, right? When we come to these parts of scripture, like, who cares where it is? Like, let's just look at the words. But the geography, the picture, kind of the surroundings actually, I think, are part of what he's about to tell us. The Sea of Galilee kind of is roughly about twice the size of Kalamalka Lake. Like, not in length, because it's actually not that much longer. It's maybe a third longer than Kalamalka Lake, quite a bit wider. So, you know, just for perspective, so you can kind of start picturing what this looks like as you're looking out to the south over the Sea of Galilee. Now, the way I picture this, and I might have a little bit of this wrong, if you've ever kind of been in one of those areas that sort of forms a natural amphitheater, remember a little while ago they were going to build a venue by Okanagan College? Anyone remember that? And I think it got voted down. But if you look at the geography, or sort of topography, I guess, the sort of this natural amphitheater, so you can kind of picture they were going to have people sitting up on the hillside, and then down below would be the stage, right? And the sound would go up, and everyone would be able to hear this. That's kind of how a natural amphitheater works. So if that is a correct understanding of the situation, most of us who picture Jesus at the top of the hill, speaking down, probably just have kind of a backwards picture. More likely, Jesus is sort of up the hillside, and there's an amphitheater around him. And actually, to this day, if you go to this part of the Sea of Galilee, you can actually see very easily how this would work. And the people probably would have been across the hillside, able to hear as he spoke up to the crowds of people, right? His voice would have just been naturally projected onto the hillside. What's really interesting then, if you can kind of picture that, is the people on the hillside were looking south over the Sea of Galilee, this beautiful countryside. Now, don't picture mountains, you know, raging up into cliffs or anything. The Sea of Galilee does kind of come up into sort of hillsides, but they're not as dramatic even as sort of the hills here in the Okanagan, although it kind of starts to get us close. If you were to picture, like, you know, I live kind of in the north end of town. If you kind of imagine, you know, Swan Lake, there's the lake, and the hillsides slowly kind of move up from there. Sea of Galilee actually is the lowest freshwater lake on the planet, right? So you can kind of picture these slowly rolling hillsides moving up, crowd up on the hillside, looking out over the Sea of Galilee as Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth." What a massive claim. You thought of that? He could have said, "You're the salt of Capernaum," or "the salt of Galilee," or maybe you're like really big, "You're the salt of Israel." Maybe even stepped up, "You're the salt of the entire Roman," but he, like, "the entire earth. You're the light of the world." I mean, that's an interesting statement. You go back to the Old Testament, Israel was to be the light of the world. At one point, Jerusalem is called the light of the world. The Roman Empire grabs a hold of that, and they actually will say, and you can find this written in Roman history, "Rome is the light of the world." Right? We are it. And Jesus says, "No, no, it's none of that. It's this little group of people. You, humanly speaking, have no resource, no prominence, no power. They've got nothing. All they have is me. But if I was to work through them and they were to follow me, they would be the light of the world." Now, what do they see as they look down this valley? It's interesting because as you look down the valley over the lake, you would see two cities. One called Magdala or Migdal. Some of you, if you know your Bible, know there's a fairly prominent Bible character. She actually carries the name Mary Magdalene, Mary of Migdal. That's her hometown, right? But if you look at sort of the other names for this town, we know it by that one name. Its more prominent name, which Greek name, is Tarikos, which means salted fish. Imagine that being your hometown. Where do you come from? Salted fish. Now, you gotta work with me on this. What do you think happened at Migdal? They salted fish. Yeah, I know. It's like, whoo, check mark. You guys are really on it this morning. Now, can I picture it? Here's these people looking down this hillside as Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth." Now, what does salt do? Some scholar out there studied it and said in the ancient world, salt has 11 functions. The articles I read never got actually around to writing what they were. I could come up with a couple. It's like, well, you can eat it. It's very tasty. It's bad for your blood pressure, but man, is it good on a potato chip, right? That's one. That's kind of maybe how we would tend to think of it. But in the ancient world, that wasn't actually the main thing, although they certainly did, and they used it to season. But the main thing is they used it to preserve. If you're living in a world where you don't have a fridge or a freezer, right, and you've got a slab of meat or a fish, and you're saying, "We're trying to take this product to a market somewhere or preserve it for our own eating," the only way you had to preserve it was salt. You would take the fish or the piece of meat, you put it sort of on a bed of salt, down it would go, then a layer of salt, then another fish or piece of meat, another layer, you'd stack it all up, and that salt had a preserving effect to it. And it made your meat really, really salty. They would wash it, and there was all sorts of things they would do with it. But that's sort of the main function. Now, as we come to this little moment in chapter 5, verse 13, Our English actually doesn't serve us really well, and I'll just show you why. When we get to this little statement where it says, but if salt has lost its taste, that one right there, that would seem to imply that what Jesus is talking about would be something like this. It's like, hey, Christian, you are the salt of the earth. You make things taste awesome. Like, you know, there's a group of people and they're not very flavorful. You sprinkle a few Christians in there. It's like, wow, you're the spice of life. That's actually not what he's getting at. He's talking about something actually shockingly different. He's looking and saying, you know what? Big conclusion number one, the world we live in is rotting. It's decaying. Now, we know it. It sounds harsh to put it that way, but you just turn on the news, log into whatever news source you want, and you just have a look at the world you live in. We should, as believers, as followers of Jesus, should not be shocked. But sometimes we are, right? You're like, wow, the world is so broken, and it's so chaotic, and it's so full of sin and bad things. It's sort of like, we should never be ones who go, wow, I never saw that coming. Because Jesus told us that this was the fundamental nature of the world we live in. And it needs, as a preserving agent, the people of God to do what they alone can do. You are the salt of the earth. And I imagine as those people were looking down that valley and looking, and their eyes couldn't help but go to Migdol and see the white of the salt still on the ground and go, oh, we understand. Just as salt is keeping that fish so that it can be eaten, so it's preserved, so it doesn't rot, we are to have a function like that in the world. Now, the big point of this analogy, though, is not even about function. It's more about the losing of saltiness. Now, if you are a chemistry student, you're about to probably want to get into an argument with Jesus. It's like, come on, Jesus, didn't you do chemistry 12? Salt is a stable compound, right? Sodium, chloride, you put them together, the electron exchange, you know, it doesn't break down. It's not like other compounds that are very unstable. So when he says, you know, that salt can lose its saltiness, it's like, well, that doesn't happen. Salt doesn't lose its saltiness. That's the brilliance of what salt is. You put it in, you know, on the little salt shaker and you put it there with, like, you know, a little rice or something in there to absorb the moisture. That stuff's going to sit there for decades and still be salt. What does he mean? That salt could lose its saltiness. Now, again, you got to go back to the ancient world that hasn't learned the same kind of refining process that we do in their salt, right? What they would do typically, especially in Israel, they would go down to the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea, if you've ever been there, salt everywhere, at least white crystallized mineral everywhere. And you would take that stuff and you would pound it up, not into the fine sort of crystal that we have, but sort of into pebble-sized stuff. And then you would have salt. But actually what you've got is contaminated salt. You've got sodium chloride, you've got actual salt, and then you've got all sorts of minerals that also look like salt. It's all white. So you would take it, you would layer your fish in that nice rock stuff, and it would preserve the rock. But gradually over time, the actual sodium chloride, the actual salt, leaches out of that rock. But it still looks like salt. And so you use it once, you maybe clean it, use it again, clean it, use it again. But you know what happens eventually? The day comes where you packed your meat, your fish, and that salt, you put it off to the side that it's going to be preserved, and you go and you unpack it to discover it rotted because your salt lost its saltiness. It looked like salt. It's still white. But if you were to take it and put it in your mouth, it's not salt anymore. It's lost something. Now, this is the point Jesus is making, right? If you see the analogy, the point he is making as he speaks to those who are following is, don't lose your saltiness. Don't become tainted with contaminants. Don't stop being what I've called you to be. Stay salt. The world needs you to be salty. Told the first service, the rabbi, this is actually disgusting, so feel free to plug your ears for just a moment. At least it seemed disgusting the first time I ever read it. The rabbis in Jesus' day had a saying. The only way to restore saltiness to salt is with a mule's afterbirth. We raise dogs, so I've seen some pretty disgusting things, around birth and all that goes on. But I read that, I'm like, that is so gross. Like, that's the way it, and then I was like, oh, the light went on. It's like, hold on. You take a horse and a donkey, you breed them together, you get a mule. You can't actually have a mule's after birth. What they were saying is, it's impossible. If salt loses its saltiness, you can't re-salt it. And Jesus is laying down this warning to us and saying, be so careful. Don't allow yourself to stop being the salt of the earth. Now, as we'll see when we get into the light of the world, I think the point he's making is everything he's just described in terms of these Beatitudes are the kind of people that we would be if we follow Jesus. So we would be people who hunger and thirst for righteousness. We'd be people who pursue mercy and be people who pursue purity of heart and our peacemaking. Is that that's salty. You do those things and you will be a preserving influence in the world that it so desperately needs. So don't stop being salt. And then, as he begins to speak next, he turns from looking down the lake to the right over at Migdol, and your eyes would just go to the opposite side of the lake to another city, this one called Hippos. Anyone know what Hippos means? Hippopotamus, horse of the sea. Hippos is a horse. You want to know the city was named Horse? It's because the mountain that it's built on top of looks like a horse. And again, this sort of low-rising slopes all of a sudden is interrupted on the east side of the Sea of Galilee by one massive mountain. And on the top of it, the Romans had built a city. They called it Hippos. Now, the Romans, you need to know something about the Romans. The Romans were convinced that if everyone could just see the glory of Rome, they would want to be Romans. They're very proud people. And there was probably lots that you could understand, the Roman peace they brought, the Roman innovation, the economy, all those kind of things that they brought to the world around them was very much an advertisement in their sort of direction, although they were like morally completely bankrupt. But they built a city, and they would often do this in areas in a very prominent location so that people would look on the city and go, that's what it means to be Roman. It was sort of like, imagine like a giant billboard advertising Rome. And so the Romans built one of these 10 cities of the Decapolis, for those who know your geography of that area, up on this plateau so that you would never not see it. If you lived in Capernaum, if you lived in Tiberias, if you lived in Magdala, you would wake up every morning, you would go to bed every night, and there it was, advertising the glory of Rome. Not that far away. The eye actually can see a single candle flame at 48 miles. Right, if you're at enough elevation so you can see out. So you can imagine the effect of a world that is at night dark. There's no street lights. There's no house lights. There's just little, you know, the little clay sort of lights that someone would have. We probably will have some at Bethlehem Stars. You can kind of see them. Little oil lamps. They don't put out a lot of light in a house that has no windows. Right? So the world at night is dark. And there is the city of Hippos. And you know what the Romans did just to make sure you'd never miss it? They lit that thing up, so that you would look and every night see the glory and splendor of Rome. And Jesus says to this group of people on this hillside, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. But it's not about the city, it's about you. It's about you, my people, following me and living out the things that I have called you to. When you do that, you cannot be hidden. It's an impossibility. The world will see. Now, verse 16 is the point. So this little phrase in Matthew's gospel is often coming out of Jesus' lips. In the same way, at the start of verse 16, is the cue that this is the application. This is the point. In the same way, what's the point, Jesus? Let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. In other words, Jesus says, Here's what's going to happen. My people, as they follow me and allow me to work in their lives, because this is all about me, it's not about you, that's why God gets the glory, right? When you live the way that you're called to live, you don't go, I nailed it. Because it's not about you or me. It's about God. So that when we do what we do as followers of Jesus and someone says, well, you live differently. Why do you do that? We're able to say, I do that because God is at work within me. He's called me to himself. He's taught me what is true, and he gives me the strength to live it out. It's all him. But they see how we live. Again, I think living out things like the Beatitudes, and we have the effect of a light that does something to those who see it. Now, last week we talked about this idea of light, right? Light sometimes draws us to it. Sometimes light makes us go, turn it off. And you see that throughout the scripture, that as followers of Jesus live in his strength and in his power and according to his teaching, we have that effect in the world. Some people will be drawn to Christ, others repelled from him, but we are the light. For those in small groups, I think a couple of the questions that we're asking this week have to do with this teaching that John really grabs a hold of. I think chapter 8, maybe 13 or 14, where he talks about Jesus is the light of the world. So just really quickly, so we understand, I think, what the picture is that Scripture is presenting is, we're actually not producing light. When Jesus says, you're the light of the world, he doesn't mean you as an independent person. You just go out and you, your own, will illuminate things. He means, as you remain in me, because I am the light. The analogy that's often used, it's been used for decades now, is Jesus is the sun, we're the moon. Make sense? The moon doesn't produce light. The moon reflects light. And so you look up at the night and you go, wow, what a bright moon. But we all know the moon's not actually producing light. The moon is only reflecting the light of the sun. And in the same way, we aren't producing light on our own. We're reflecting the light of Jesus. But sometimes you look up in that dark night and there is this brilliant full moon and it feels almost like daytime, right? Because the moon's really doing its job. Then there's those other nights. You ever looked up and you're like looking, it's like, where is the moon? Oh, there it is, that little sliver over there. And Jesus, in effect, is saying, don't be the little sliver moon. Like, dwell in me, remain in me, follow me, listen to me, so that you are the bright, bold, light-giving source for a world that desperately needs it. Now, there's some implications, right, to these sayings. Let me suggest two of them. One, if what Jesus is saying is true, then our world is rotting and dark. Pretty bleak, right? We might try to say we are enlightened and that we, you know, really have some things figured out. And Jesus is coming along and he's saying, you're not. Let me just tell you the truth, you're not. And you're not getting better and better and progressing more and more and doing all these wonderful things. It's just perpetual brokenness that comes with the human heart that is foolish and dark and rotting and in desperate need for followers of Jesus to live out their faith in this world, because we actually are a preserving element. There's actually a lot of study done of revivals. So I don't know if you've ever thought of this, but I hear every once in a while people pray for revivals. That's a great thing to pray for, by the way, as long as you understand what it is you're praying for. Because I think usually when we pray for revival, it goes something like this. Lord, there are so many lost people out there, which is true. And then, Lord, would you send revival? And I think what we mean is, would you save all of them? But actually, a revival is not actually quite that. Revival, by definition and implication, is, Lord, there's a whole lot of followers of Jesus, and we aren't doing that well. Would you revive us? Because, oh, if we really understood the treasure who is Jesus, and we really followed him, then something would happen. In every historic revival, it's always started with the people of Jesus taking him seriously, confessing sin, drawing near to him. Then something happens. Step two of every revival. People start noticing. It's like, well, hold on a sec. You look different. Right? And as we follow Jesus, just know if you've signed up to follow him, your life will be increasingly different from the world. But as we take him seriously and our lives start to look different, we actually start functioning like salt and light. People go, hold on a second. There's something different. That's step two. Step three is, the world around us starts to change. Maybe not massively, but there's little changes. There's enough of us that we start to make a difference in the community that we are part of. And people look at that and go, there's something to consider. The fourth step in every historical revival is people on the outside saying, I'm going to follow Jesus too. Which leads then to this domino effect, because that's sort of normally what we know about revival is like, wow, there's people coming to Jesus and whole communities are changed, but it all starts with people saying, I'm actually going to follow Jesus and allow him to work within me so that I would actually be different in the ways he's calling me to. Now, the second big conclusion, just so I don't forget it, is that Jesus is clearly saying we are different than the world. And maybe that goes without saying, but let's just say it out loud, right? There is you and the earth. You, salt, earth. There is you, light, and the world. It's not all the same. We're not all part of just one big family. And if we try to be just a part of it, not understanding our distinct role, not in some sort of arrogant, proud way, but in humility, understanding that the only reason we're different is because of Jesus, but we are different. If we don't understand that role, there is no way we can be salt and light like Jesus has called us to. It just won't happen. We will just blend in. And Jesus wants us to be distinct. Okay, how are we doing here? Wow. Don't worry, lunch is in the other room. For some of you, some of us, it's getting closer, but not quite there. A few other passages. Three. I'm going to just take you to three spots, okay? That I hope will encourage and then clarify one application of what this might look like. The first one is 1 Peter chapter 2, and I'm struck because Peter would have been there on that hillside that day, right? The disciples gathered around to hear. Peter is one of the disciples. He would have heard, and it's interesting to me that many years later, when he writes, it's actually very clearly a certainty. Because of who you are and your calling in Jesus, as you follow him, God is saying, this is a slam dunk. You will do this because I'm going to be in you. And this is what happens when I am in my people. They proclaim the excellencies of the one who called him out of darkness into his marvelous light. An application, Philippians chapter 2. What things should I be considering as a follower of Jesus to live out saltiness and lightness in the world around me? I'll just be honest with you. When I say this, there's a quality. I hate this in the sense that when I hold this scripture up to me and I look into the mirror, it is one of the most convicting things you could ever read for me. Here's what Paul says. This is right after speaking of Jesus and his unbelievable humility in setting aside his glory to come, right? That incredible statement that ends in verse 11, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So one day we will understand his glory, but look what happens next. Therefore, this is the application. This is the point, Paul says, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it's God who works in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. In other words, any saltiness, any lightness, God gets the credit, right? That's why God is glorified when people see this in us. Verse 14, do all things without grumbling or disputing. At a Bible school teacher, you always used to say, all means all, and that's all means. All things. I wake up in the morning, particularly this time of year, and one of the first things I do is I look out the window. It's usually still dark, but I'm like squinting out the window to see if there's snow on the ground. Because literally, when there's snow on the ground, there is this sound that comes out of my body. It's hard to create. It's a spontaneous sound. It's like a groaning, horrific sound that you would go, oh, that poor animal is dying. It's like, that's, I know some of you are like, we love it. We see it and like, whoa, what a great day. Do everything without complaining. Now listen to where he goes next. Verse 15, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation among whom you shine as lights in the world. There it is. Jesus says one aspect of shining as a light in the world is doing all things without grumbling or disputing. If my people did this, they would be so distinct. Why? Because we have a world in which complaining and groaning and disputing is just epidemic. It's just what we do. Every piece of information causes someone among us to groan. You know, the stock market, your sports team, whatever. It's like, woohoo, do everything differently. Because when people see that, they will understand that does not look like how the world functions, and it will give you the opportunity to say, the only reason I can do what I'm doing without grumbling and complaining is because I put my hope on something far greater than the weather or the team or the market or my grades or my promotion. My hope is in Jesus, and he is constant. He never changes. Now, will that make a difference? And here's where we're coming to the end, Luke chapter 14. Here's my encouragement to you. Because there are times, and I think I've had conversations with some of you over the years, where it's very easy to look around the world and go, it's hopeless. Like, we don't dispute for a second that this world is dark and rotting. Like, that is absolutely apparent. What's not apparent is that a few of us Christians could actually make a difference. That seems like the impossible piece. Like, you really think if I just live out my faith, if I am like salt and light and I just don't grumble, that somehow that's going to make a difference in a world that seems so utterly hopeless. My answer is without a doubt. I have absolute confidence in that. And it comes from places like Luke 14. Luke 14, very, very interesting. Read the whole thing sometime. But it arrives at the story Jesus tells about the parable of a great banquet. You remember the man? He's going to throw a great banquet. And he sends out an invitation. And what happens? No one comes. And we go, yeah, see? There. That's exactly what we thought. Isn't the point of that to say, you know, we go out and Jesus, you know, gives this great invitation and we live out our faith, but no one shows up at the end. Point proven, the world is rotten and it's dark and that's the end of the story. But it's not. The end of the chapter, Jesus comes back to this idea of salt, verse 14. Salt is good. Like, where did that come from? He hasn't been talking about salt. Salt is good, but if it's lost its taste, if it's become foolish, it's foolish salt now. That's what actually the word means. It's the same word in Romans 1:22 and 1 Corinthians 1:20, by the way. Wise and foolish. This is foolish salt. It's not doing what salt's supposed to do. How shall its saltiness be restored? It's of no use, either for the soil or for the manure pile. It's thrown away. He who has an ear, let him hear. Now, if we stop there with the red letters of Jesus in verse 14, and we're going, I don't know why he said that. I don't know what Luke wants us to see. You just told us about a great banquet and people don't really show up. And then you tell us we're supposed to be salt. And we're still left going, what's the picture being painted? Keep reading. One more verse. Now the tax collectors and sinners. And I'll tell you right now, those are the people who don't show up to banquets. Those are the people who cause us to go, the world is so dark and hopeless. These are the worst of the worst. These are not the people who you look around and go, well, you know what? They're really good people. And if we just add Jesus in, have you ever known someone like that? It's like, wow, they are just wholesome living. They're great people. They're nice. If we just add Jesus in, they'll be the perfect Christian. These are not them. These are the people that are so far from Jesus that you, at the end of the day, go, there's no hope. We can be salt and light in front of them, but they are so opposed to Jesus that they will remain dark. They will remain rot because it doesn't seem like there's any way that the power of the gospel could break in. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him. Think of that for a second. The power of the gospel, the power of Jesus to take people that we would not look and go, oh, there's hope for them. We would say the opposite. And what happens? What's Luke showing us? It's like, don't you ever give up on the power of Jesus to transform people's lives. The next verse, and the Pharisees and scribes grumbled. Man, I want to be on the team that doesn't grumble. I want to be on the crew that points people to Jesus because we don't give up on being salt and light because we know that there are people who will hear Jesus. They will see the glory of God through how we live.